Thank you very much, David, and good morning, everybody. I've been asked to talk about the economic aspects of housing here this morning. And in keeping with this, I'll start with a few words on the Australian economy and then discuss the implications this has for the housing market. And in doing that, I want to look at three specific questions, namely, are we building enough dwellings? Is there enough housing finance? And why are dwelling prices in Australia high relative to income? The Reserve Bank's published a lot of material on the global and Australian economies recently, and I won't go over all that material in detail, but I do want to draw out some of the key highlights. And the first point I want to make is that it's now clear that the global economy is growing again after some very sharp falls in economic activity late last year and early this year. Virtually all economies recorded growth in the September quarter, and the information available so far for the December quarter suggests that this expansion has continued. It's also clear that the economies of the North Atlantic are lagging behind those in other parts of the world, particularly those in Asia. It's not surprising that the North Atlantic economies are lagging because they were at the centre of the global financial crisis. Many of the banks in that region are still at the early stages of repairing their balance sheets, and this is limiting their capacity to lend money. Banks elsewhere are in much better shape. While they were caught up in the squeeze in global money markets that flowed from the events in the United States last year, they generally did not experience severe credit losses. Once the liquidity pressures passed, financial intermediation in these countries has tended to normalise, and this has certainly been the case in the Asian region. More generally, the economies in the Asian region have responded well to the accommodative macroeconomic policies and the governments have put in place, and economic activity in these countries has rebounded strongly. This is positive for Australia because Asian countries are our major trading partners. So while the world economy as a whole is forecast to remain relatively sluggish next year, economic growth in the group of countries that comprise our major trading partners is expected to recover to a relatively normal pace. Some commentators question the capacity of Asia to continue to grow if the developed economies remain weak. And while there's no doubt that weakness in the developed economies would have an adverse effect on Asia's growth prospects, we should not lose sight of the fact that most of the growth in the larger Asian economies comes from their own domestic demand. And importantly, these countries have plenty of scope to pursue policies that sustain that demand. Let me now turn to the Australian economy. The key point here is that this local economy has held up much better than we expected earlier in the year. Australia is the only developed economy where year-end growth in GDP did not go negative during the past year. It's now 18 years since Australia has experienced a negative in year-end GDP growth. This is a very prolonged economic expansion. With the economy having only just recently entered a new upswing, it's reasonable to assume that we'll see this growth extended for a few more years yet. Over the next few years, Australia is also expected to see a further expansion in the resources sector, including the development of some very large gas projects. Mining investment is already at record levels relative to GDP, and it's expected to rise substantially further in the next 5 years or so. If this scenario eventuates, it will have very powerful and broad-ranging implications for the economy. Glenn Stevens and Ken Henry have both recently addressed these. I won't go over all that ground again today, but as far as the housing market is concerned, I think it's worth looking at the key implications. First, the rate of growth of the population is likely to remain strong because demand for labour will encourage continued high immigration. Household incomes are likely to rise solidly, and this will underpin demand for housing. And the construction industry is likely to face substantial competition for workers from the mining sector. So while this suggests a generally positive environment for the housing sector, it is one which is not going to be without challenges. I've just said, Glenn Stevens recently said one of the key challenges facing the housing industry is making sure that the supply of housing is able to respond adequately to the increased demand for accommodation. There's a broad consensus that in recent years Australia has not built enough dwellings. A good indication of this is the very low vacancy rates in rental markets. This shortfall in housing, however, is not because as a nation we've cut back on investment in dwellings. In fact, the opposite is true. Over the past decade, dwelling investment has been higher as a percent of GDP than it has typically been in the past. It's up around 6%. So how do we square up the seemingly contradictory evidence that overall investment in housing is high, yet there seems to be a shortage of dwellings? And I think there's four factors that explain this contradiction. First, Australians are spending, on average, a lot more on each new dwelling. Average real expenditure on each new dwelling built now is 60% higher than it was 15 years ago. This is due to improvements in quality and increases in size. Second, a high proportion of dwelling investment is in the form of alterations and additions, that is, upgrading existing houses rather than building new ones. Almost half of all new dwelling investment, of all dwelling investment, sorry, has been accounted for by alterations and additions in recent years. Third, a high proportion of new houses built are simply replacing existing houses that have been demolished. We estimate that between 2001 and 2006, around 15% of the new houses built simply replaced houses that had been demolished. 10 to 15 years earlier, that figure was substantially less than 10%. And fourth, a significant proportion of dwelling investment appears to have gone into holiday houses and second homes. Census data show that the number of dwellings built has exceeded the number of households by a large margin. As a result, the ratio of the number of dwellings to the number of households has been rising over time. As of 2006, there were 8% more dwellings in Australia than there were households. Presumably, most of this surplus reflects holiday houses and second homes. In short, the apparent contradiction between the shortage of dwellings and the high investment arises because a high proportion of dwelling investment is going into improving the quality of existing dwellings and building accommodation additional to primary residences. If as a nation we want to continue to do this, while at the same time providing enough dwellings for a growing population, the overall amount of dwelling investment undertaken will need to rise relative to GDP. That would raise important challenges for the housing industry in terms of its capacity to meet that demand. It would, of course, also raise the question of which of the other expenditure components of GDP should bear the offsetting fall in share. Let me now turn to the question of housing finance. Over the past couple of years, there's been a significant change in the structure of the housing finance market, with lenders that were funding themselves through securitisation cutting back substantially on their new lending. Increases in the cost of funds for these lenders made it largely uneconomic for them to lend. Their declining market share has been picked up by the major banks, and these banks now account for 80% of all new housing loans. These developments have led to concerns that borrowers may not have sufficient access to loans or that the cost of new loans might increase. However, to date at least, the evidence suggests that we should not be overly concerned about these things. On the question of cost, margins on housing loans have, if anything, narrowed a little over the past couple of years, even for the major banks. 2 years ago, the interest rates charged by the major banks on new variable rate housing loans were around 190 basis points above their cost of funds. The margin today is slightly narrower. To the extent that there has been a widening in banks' margins, it's been in their business lending. So far at least, it appears that there is still sufficient competition in the housing loan market for lenders not to have been able to widen their margins. The government has helped to sustain this competition by putting in place arrangements to encourage continued securitisation of housing loans. The Australian Office of Financial Management has been buying mortgage-backed securities from these lenders at yields that, during the crisis, were well below those available in the secondary market, though they were still very attractive in absolute terms. This helped keep the cost of funds to these firms at levels that allowed them to continue lending, although at a much reduced rate from that in earlier years. The government has also recently announced an expansion in this program by the AOFM. At the same time, issuers of mortgage-backed securities are finding that market conditions are improving, spreads are coming down, and it is again becoming economic to issue securities into the market. As my colleague Guy DeBell said last week, the Australian securitisation market has suffered reputational damage from the events in the United States. However, Australian mortgage-backed securities have not experienced credit problems and they remain sound, very financially sound. I'm confident that this fundamental point will eventually see the securitisation market return to being an important source of funding for housing loans. In the meantime, increased lending by banks means that the total amount of new loans available is still relatively high. In fact, new loan approvals are at levels which indicate a degree of home buyer activity that has typically been associated with rising house prices. At the same time, however, existing borrowers are continuing to take advantage of low interest rates to make accelerated loan repayments, and this is restraining the overall growth of credit. Even so, housing credit is growing by around 7 or 8% a year, which is more than adequate to fund the new investment in housing that is needed. I'll turn now to the question of housing prices. There's a common perception that house prices relative to household income in Australia are high, both compared with other countries and with our own history. I think Jeff showed some graphs that indicated that. And it's certainly the case that house prices in Australia relative to income are higher than they were 20 years ago. However, this is largely explained by the fact that the fall in inflation over that period has allowed nominal interest rates on average to be lower now than they used to be. Lower interest rates allow households to take out bigger housing loans without increasing their housing loan repayments. This in turn has given households more buying capacity in the housing market and this is reflected in house prices. International comparisons of the relativity between house prices and income have been the subject of considerable research over recent years. But one of the challenges faced by people working on this topic is to ensure consistency in the data that underlie the comparisons. For example, do the house price figures relate to capital city prices or to prices across the whole country? Do they cover dwellings, all dwellings, or just detached houses? And is income that is being measured average weekly earnings, or is it average household disposable income? It's not always possible to get entirely consistent data across countries, so we need to be very careful in interpreting the results of these comparisons. Most people agree, however, that the ratio of house prices to income in Australia is higher than in the United States. One explanation that is put forward for this is that the Australian population is more concentrated in a few large cities where house prices are high, even relative to income. This seems to be a plausible explanation from a social geography point of view, but there must also be a financial explanation, otherwise we'd expect to observe that housing stress among Australians is higher than in the United States, and this is clearly not the case. Housing loan arrears in Australia are typically much lower than those in the United States, despite a higher ratio of house prices to income. There are a couple of reasons why Australian households seem to be able to sustain a higher ratio of house prices to income. First, Australians seem to spend less of their income on non-housing consumption than is the case for households in the United States. And a significant part of this difference is due to the lower health costs in Australia. Australian households therefore have greater capacity to service housing loans. Second, the level of gearing in the US housing market is a lot higher than in Australia. This may reflect the fact that Australian households are more active in paying down their loans after buying a house. The faster paydown of mortgage debt in Australia reduces the risk that borrowers subsequently get into trouble. Overall, the experience of the last few years suggests that the Australian household sector as a whole appears to have the financial capacity to sustain a relatively high ratio of house prices to income. That capacity, however, is not evenly distributed through the population. Many 50 to 60 year olds, having benefited from prolonged economic expansion over the past couple of decades and having accumulated large superannuation savings, are in a very strong financial position. This has encouraged a change in behaviour by this group, with many of these households now being more inclined to stay geared up later in life, using the funds to upgrade and expand their dwelling investments. It is likely that this changed behaviour by this group has been a significant factor in the housing developments we've seen in Australia over the past 10 to 15 years. In contrast, the typical first homeowner cohort, that is those under 35 years of age, has experienced a noticeable decline in home ownership over the past 10 to 15 years. It may be that this has been driven by demographic factors, such as the fact that young people are staying in education longer and delaying the formation of new households, but there may also be financial reasons for it. A particular problem for first homeowners is that the ratio of house prices to income has substantially increased the deposit needed to get into the market. On plausible assumptions, the deposit needed for first homeowners now may be around 1.25 years of income. This is almost twice what it was 15 years ago. At one stage, lenders were responding to this by lowering the deposit requirement, but this carried the risk of buyers subsequently getting into difficulty. As the Premier mentioned, various governments have also been trying to help in this area by providing concessions to first homeowners through grants and tax relief. However, while these measures assist the first wave of buyers who are able to take advantage of them, the benefits tend to diminish over time because these concessions tend to become capitalised into higher house prices. I'm conscious that I've raised a lot of issues here and provided very few answers, but nonetheless I'm going to stop and I'll leave it to your discussions over the next couple of days to try and find some of these answers. Thank you very much.